listen to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Rogue Startups Podcast. Today, Dave is out at Big Snow Tiny Conf West, so I hope, Dave, you're enjoying fantastic snow out there and the company of some awesome entrepreneurs. And I am joined on the podcast this week by my good friend Andrew Culver. So, Andrew, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, Craig?
Doing good. Thank you. Wishing I was skiing today, but you know, that's how it is. It's like 2 degrees and raining here, so it's like kind of horrible, yep. But it's all good. So I think most folks who listen to the show know who Andrew is. So a founder of Churnbuster, who has then since kind of sold it, and it's in other hands at this point. But Andrew, I guess maybe since the Churnbuster days, do you want to kind of give folks an update of kind of who you are and what you've been up to in the last couple of years?
Yeah, absolutely. So Churnbuster was great. That was my first product. I had a product before that that I launched, got out there, and it never really amounted to anything. And then Churnbuster was that product that when I was a consultant, that came out of some work that I was doing for a company where I was spending a ton of time working on this particular problem of failed payments. And we kind of identified, like, we're spending a ton of time on this and it's not our core competency. And I brokered a deal with the CEO of that company and said, hey, look, I have other people that are trying to get me to do this for them as well. And what I can do is I can just make this its own product. I can charge you, $200 a month for it instead of, $1,500 a month in consulting that we were spending at the time around that problem. And then also I can subsidize the cost of its development by selling it to all these other people as well. And so Churnbuster was super exciting because it was the first time I had that recurring revenue product that was actually successful, all the way up until the point where if I had wanted to work on it full time, I could have done that. And it sort of didn't work out that way. So what I ended up doing was selling Churnbuster and working at another company called Borrowed in Blue. And I was working there full time as their CTO. It was a super well compensated position. They had just started. I had been their consultant developer for 3 years up until that point, at the same time that I was building Churnbuster. And they started raising funds. That came with kind of the pressure to, hey, can you go full time? If I had to do it again, I wouldn't do it. But I did it because it seemed like the right decision at the time. And in the process of doing that, that was a huge motivation for me to sell Churnbuster, which was exciting. Like, it was not only exciting to have built a product that actually you could work on this full time if you wanted to, but it was also super exciting to, have an exit or like have a product that somebody thought was valuable enough that they were willing to pay you, a big chunk of change in exchange for it. So I would say overall it was a success. If I had to do it again, I wouldn't. I think the lesson learned there was once you have worked for yourself full time, probably it's pretty difficult to go back and work full time for somebody else.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, it wasn't super long lived. I hired a lot of people at Borrowed in Blue. And left that sort of in a good place where I could then leave. And so after a year in that position, I decided, this isn't the right direction in my career that I want to take. I do want to be working on products. I do want to be self-employed. And so at that point, my wife and I and the family, we took a sabbatical, spent 6 months in Japan, spent a little time in, we also visited, Australia, South Korea, spent time in Canada, where I grew up. And then we moved back at the beginning of last year. We moved back to California and started doing products the way that I know how to do products, which is you get consulting work and you use consulting work to fund the development of your products. That way you've got good, healthy cash flow and you are kind of in the mix of like where problems are being solved, which is what I do in my consulting work. And from that consulting work, you start generating ideas for what could be some pretty good products. Yeah. So out of that, as you know, but for the sake of the folks that are listening, out of that work that I was doing as a consultant, one of the things that was sort of a recurring theme of what people wanted me to build for them. And this probably had to do a little bit with my background working on Churnbuster. But also, there's an open source library that myself and Christoph Engelhart, a mutual friend of ours, have been maintaining for years called Kodoku, which is a drop-in subscription engine for Rails apps that integrates with Stripe. And I mean, that library itself has sort of fallen, I think, into disrepair. But I think because of that, there are some connections that I've made with people that use it who are in the SaaS space. And so I end up getting people coming to me saying like, hey, can you help me build a SaaS business or a SaaS product? And that was a really common theme, to the point where it was almost like, okay, I'm getting sick of doing the same thing over and over and over. And that was the impetus for creating Bullet Train.
Gotcha. And so for the folks who kind of haven't been keeping up with you, I love kind of the tweet storms that you do every once in a while about Bullet Train to update people and talk about releases and stuff. But for the folks who haven't followed along with what Bullet Train is exactly, you give like a quick synopsis of what it is and what the purpose is around it.
Yeah, absolutely. So Bullet Train is, I call it a SaaS in a box. And the philosophy...
Not to be confused with the Justin Timberlake Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. So with Bullet Train, the philosophy behind Bullet Train is, even for me when I was building Churnbuster, it was still, I think, relatively early days where, you know, a lot of the tools had just come out that made it easy to launch a SaaS, but it wasn't super competitive or a ton of saturation in some of the common SaaS markets. Now, if you look at the SaaS landscape, the bar is so high, unless you're building super niche things. I think there's still great opportunity there, you know, following that whole thread of software eating the world. I think there are still tons and tons of opportunities to build products, especially, and I think this is the important differentiation for me. Some people think of SaaS and they think of huge products like Basecamp or, you know, I don't know, Gusto or whatever. Like
Intercom.
And some of these are bootstrapped businesses, but some of them are also these huge venture-backed companies, these massive products. But I think there's also, you know, SaaS products to be created for, you know, HVAC companies, and they don't necessarily have to be huge products. That's actually a pretty huge market, but there are these niche opportunities. Here's the challenge. The market has to be big enough to provide a return on investment. Now, you may not be able to build a 50-person company building products for some of these niche markets. I don't care about that. For me, the exciting thing was with Churnbuster that even me as an individual developer could carve out a self-sufficient living from a SaaS app, to like that lifestyle business sort of idea. And that to me is what's really super exciting. And I think there's a ton of opportunity for people to do that, even in these niche spaces. But here's the challenge. The overhead of building out all the features that are common in a SaaS app makes it's almost prohibitive to build some of these smaller applications, because there's so much effort required just to meet kind of the minimum bar of a SaaS app. And so I think in some cases, people have some pretty good ideas, but it's not so easy to get a product to market because of the barrier, not the barrier to entry, but the barrier to entry, all of the things that they have to build. And Kodoku was the first step, like make it easy to drop in a pricing page, upgrade, downgrade, all of that stuff. Bullet Train is this concept on a whole other level. So we are taking everything that is common to all of these different SaaS apps and making it out of the box. Like, we're providing that for you so that as a developer, you can focus on the one thing that your app is actually about. So it might be, I don't know, like it could be anything, but whatever that idea is for an app that the person listening has that they could provide to businesses, the unique value that they're providing is not authentication. It's not subscriptions. It's not plans and upgrading and downgrading. It's not Teams. It's not the invitation system by which their users can invite other users to join them in their account. It's not in the API documentation. It's not in any of that stuff. It's not even in the test suite that makes sure that all of those things are working well. But I tell you what, it took us months to build all of those things in a best of breed sort of fashion, so that your SaaS app, when you launch it, is going to be competitive and look like a very professional SaaS application with all the features that people expect a SaaS app to have. But really, all you did was write a couple of classes that process a CSV in a certain way, or, you know, glue together a Twitter account and a Facebook account and some spreadsheet or whatever. Like, whatever the thing is that you do, you focus on making that amazing, and we'll make it sellable. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, totally, totally. And I love this kind of like taking a common problem that people have over and over, creating a like one click, if you will, solution for it, and then letting them go and focus on what's really important. I think that's the key, is if you can take and either give people more money or more time, then you have something that's really valuable. And I think this is doing a little bit of both, right? Because you're reducing developer time, which is money, as well. So I think it sounds like a slam dunk. I mean, we've been living in the Laravel world with Castos for the last year, and they have something Absolutely. Called Spark, which is probably more similar to what you and Christoph developed initially. I think it's not super, super comprehensive, but it's a really good starting place. So I think you're definitely spot on with Bullet Train. And I know, talking to other Rails people, that they're really excited about this coming out. And you just recently kind of put it on public launch and availability, right? So people can go out and check out Bullet Train and buy it now.
Yeah, so it is available. It's still early days for its development. I think this was a real challenge for me, is that my vision for what Bullet Train is going to be is ridiculously large. So I'll give you an example of something that we do that you wouldn't expect that we do. In the standard Bullet Train app, there's already a bunch of infrastructure in place. Like it looks beautiful, right? So it uses a UI toolkit that looks very good. And then built into it, for example, is when somebody signs up in the default Bullet Train app, you already have the ability for them to connect Twitter accounts, and there's going to be the ability to connect Facebook accounts or connect Xero accounts or all of these different providers for OAuth. We're going to have like a system built in that makes it not just like OmniAuth, which is on the server side, but at the top level of like what's the actual process for somebody connecting their account and then managing the accounts that are connected within their account for a Bullet Train app. That's just one example of like how far we want to push it in terms of out of the box functionality. It's going to basically become like a new development environment to build your apps within. So the vision is very broad. And I think it was really difficult for me to realize that, like, look, you can't just do this behind the scenes forever. It's not even that exciting. Like, I stopped getting excited about doing the tweet storms because it's like, dude, you're just talking about this stuff that's only on your computer. And the only people that are using it are people that are like sending you DMs saying like, hey, man, can I please have private access?
Right.
But launching something, the bigger the product becomes, the harder it is to launch because you need all the supporting documentation and marketing and stuff like that. And I think I just realized that in this bootstrapped world, like it's not going to have the polished TechCrunch sort of launch. What I needed to do is just make it available and build out that marketing effort behind it piece by piece. But as a component is ready, ship it. Don't wait for everything to be ready. Don't wait for everything to be perfect. Just get it out there and then iterate as a result of the conversations that you're having because of that thing that you did. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, totally. I mean, I think that having conversations with paying customers is really different than someone who's like, hey, I'm an early access. I'm your buddy from Twitter. Can I have access? And I'll give you some feedback on this. But somebody who cancels because they don't like something is infinitely more valuable than a buddy saying, yeah, this would be nice if you had XYZ. But yeah, I mean, so our hosting platform now, Castos, has been live since May of last year. And we just launched on beta list a couple of weeks ago, and we haven't launched on Product Hunt or anything like that yet. So, I mean, I think you can get out there and start making good money without, quote, launching. in the kind of big official way that a lot of people talk about, get a lot of feedback, get a bunch of customers, and then iterate from there. Because the sad reality is nobody cares. Most people won't even see it at first, right? So just get it out there.
Yep.
Get some real, honest, actual, real world feedback. And then when the time, for me, the best part of this is like when the time comes for like the big player to come in and start using your app, it's been really battle tested. And we've had some people, huge kind of WordPress people, come in and start using our platform now. And I feel really good to say, okay, this is good. This is good. Watch out for this. It's not a huge deal, but just so you know, you want to, you know, kind of use our tool like this and that, that I wouldn't have had the confidence to be able to have an honest conversation with them if I didn't have, you know, hundreds of users in there using the app and giving us feedback every day. So yeah, I think it's invaluable to have real world feedback as soon as you can, and don't worry about it being perfect before you start getting it. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and there's a balance between those two things, right? Like I remember with ChurnBuster, it was Josh Pigford at Bear Metrics that really shamed me into launching. And that was because they were already using ChurnBuster for like months, like maybe half a year. And there were other people as well that had been using it for a long time, raving about it, really loved it. The word of mouth was really good, but I never did a formal launch. In fact, I was so bad at this that by the time I sold ChurnBuster, I still hadn't emailed the launch list, which is an awful admission. Like there was probably so much potential. Well, maybe it was very stale, but there was potentially a lot of lead work that I could, or sales work I could have done on that list to grow the company even before I sold it. But it was Josh that one day just said to me like, "Hey, bud, you are going to launch by this day, or I'm going to launch for you and start sending people, you know, to you directly." Right. I forget how he threatened it, but he forced me into the light. And there is a balance, right? Like you do have to do marketing. And I think that's a trap a lot of developers follow into, is like just working on the product endlessly. You do have to get out there. But I that also was another example where that was a very rolling launch where a lot of people had been using the product, similar to what you described. And yeah, you know what? That worked really well. I think with Bullet Train, my goal is to do a better job on the marketing side. And some of that is easy for me. Like the tweet storms are really easy, and they seem to be a really effective channel for communicating to people about what Bullet Train is and the philosophy and stuff like that. But I really do want to do a better job this time of kind of executing in all of the important channels, like email marketing and blogging and stuff like that. And I think that is going to be where a lot of our customer pipeline comes from.
Sure. I mean, as everyone who knows me and listens to the show knows that I am not a developer, even though I pretend sometimes to try. But even someone who, like myself, who just has the marketing to focus on, there is a ton of stuff to focus on with marketing. And I mean, some days I just work all day and feel like I haven't done anything, even though I've been kind of marketing and doing business operation stuff all day. I can't imagine being a developer and having the balance of working on the product itself, along with all the other lists of hundreds of things you have to do as a bootstrapped owner. So yeah, I mean, the marketing can definitely get away from you sometimes, but I think that especially as you start to get customers, it gets easier and it gets more fun to have those conversations with them and have customer conversations guide the direction of the product and stuff. For me, that's been the best part, is talking to customers, getting their feedback, good or bad, and then going to the product team and saying, okay, we need to do this, we need to do that, we need to throw this away. You know, like I think that information is so valuable. But so we are going to talk mostly today about something that is highly debated and everyone has an opinion on, and that is testing. So Dave would probably be a better person to talk to you about this since he's a developer, but as a non-technical...
No, this is perfect, Craig.
Yeah, no,
I think... I can say whatever I want.
And I don't know any difference. No, I think this is good because you are a very technical person. You have a lot of marketing chops and a lot of business sense. And myself, coming as like a non-technical founder, for all those non-technical people who listen to the show, I think might relate to my perspective when it comes to testing. And I'll kind of frame why I wanted to have you on the show. One, because you have a very unique and interesting perspective on testing, and I definitely want to get into that and let you kind of explain how you test and where you're coming from with that. And I'll have a bunch of questions, I'm sure. But for myself, the question really comes up, I think, do you test your SaaS app? Do you have unit tests? Do you have class tests? Do you have feature tests or what? Browser tests, front-end tests, automated? What do you deploy through something like CodeShip or something like that? All of these questions, right? And everyone has an opinion on the, quote, right way to do it. I know in the Rails world, test-driven development is really common, and most people think that's how you should do it. In the PHP world, coming from the Laravel side, it's not as much. I know Adam Wathman is really kind of getting on that train, no pun intended, but and is kind of preaching a lot of test-driven development in Laravel. And so I think it's coming more and more to be mainstream there. But as a business owner and someone who's not a developer, I look at tests on the surface and say, wow, that's just a huge waste of time and just a huge time and energy suck for my developers. But then I know as the apps get bigger and bigger and more complex, having test coverage in your SaaS app allows you to move faster, make more progress, and change more things with the confidence that what you're doing is not going to break your app and screw your users. So I guess with that kind of framing, I wanted to have you on to talk about testing. And in full disclosure, our SaaS app has zero tests at this point, and it is definitely something that I want to start implementing. But I don't want to just say, okay, stop developing new features for the next 2 months and go write tests for every piece of code we have. So I want to get like the 80-20, right? How can we cover most of the really important stuff in our app in a way that makes the most kind of business and development sense, and do it in kind of a cost-effective way and not waste a whole bunch of resources for anybody? So that's a very long preamble to kind of talking about testing, but I guess...
No way. That wasn't long at all. That was the perfect setup, Craig. Like, delete the rest of the episode up until this point or split it into two. That was, honestly, that's the perfect setup. The perfect setup for what I would sort of my thoughts on this. I'm in exactly the same place as you because, I come from a developer background. I've been developing for over a decade professionally. But at a certain point, I also felt like I grew out of simply being content on the engineering side. And this is interesting because I had the opportunity to do this twice. The first time was when I worked in a big corporation where I was in an engineering track and it sort of leveled out or topped off at a certain point. And this is really common actually, or was 10 years ago, where the only path for promotion then became getting into management. Mm-hmm. And that was the wrong graduation. I definitely didn't want to be managing proprietary corporate human dysfunction. That was the wrong graduation or not even graduation, but sort of growing out of simply being an engineering person. And then what I left that company, started working in consulting, became self-employed, and found the right transition for me, which was into more business orientation, product orientation, self-employment, things like that. And that, when you come from that perspective, it completely changes, I think, the way that you look at some of these engineering practices. And you shift from a focus on what's technically correct or ideal. And in this case, I would say that even what people preach as the ideal is not actually ideal. And you start shifting to a focus on what is valuable, what is enough, what's the best return on investment. And I feel like your whole intro just sets that conversation up perfectly. I agreed with everything that you said.
Yeah. Awesome. So yeah, so I know I have the spoiler in my head. I know you have a very, not contrarian, unique perspective on testing. So you want to give folks kind of a brief kind of sense of where you are and how you think about testing in a SaaS app these days?
Yeah, so I will answer some of the questions that you brought up. Do I test my SaaS app? Absolutely. In fact, bullet train testing is so critically important because in our case, we already have a number of SaaS apps that depend on our code continuing to work as we push out updates, right? So I have a test suite that runs in like eight different configurations that it has to run. And every time we add a configuration option, that number doubles because we have to test all combinations of all configuration options. Takes quite a long time to test just the bullet train framework itself. Although if you build a bullet train app, it doesn't take as long because you're only testing one configuration. So of course I test. My big shift in focus though has been from and I think this is the answer to your, how do you get 80% of the benefit for 20% of the effort? My focus in testing is primarily now on integration testing or feature level testing, and much less on unit testing for, you know, all of the different types of components, models and views and controllers and service objects and all of that stuff. My focus on testing at that level has reduced substantially. And this isn't a change that I just made one day. It is something that I came to over time. I think I was very hesitant to make the shift. I was hesitant to make the shift. And you know why? It's because there are members of the development community that I have a ton of respect for that feel very vocal or feel very strongly and are very vocal about the approach to testing, test-driven development being one example. But so you start having these thoughts and you're like, oh man, if I start telling people about this stuff, this is not, I'm going to be blacklisted or people are going to think I'm a cowboy coder or something like that. And but over time, I realized as I disclosed my approach to testing to the people that I was developing software for, which are business people, I'm approaching this like, man, I got to really disclose this because some other developer is going to look at this and then they're going to badmouth, you know, me for the way that I've done this testing. And what I realized is that the business owners understand this. They understand that there is a risk of over engineering, and that comes with costs. And yeah, so we can talk about some of that. But that's been the shift in my perspective. So I still do test. I think as much code coverage as you can, highest levels. So my perspective on this, I really want to make sure that people don't misconstrue this as I don't think testing is important. The testing is extremely important. I just want as high value tests as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. So kind of feature driven testing is the term I know that you've talked about some. So can you give for me and maybe for everyone else an example of what that might look like? So we're a podcast hosting app. What would a feature test look like?
Yeah, so an integration or a feature test is different than a unit test and I might get the specific definitions here wrong, like somebody might have a more correct definition. But the point is you're testing the whole thing or you're testing one part, but from top to bottom, touching every part of the application that causes a feature to exist the way that it does. So if you consider what the way that you test when you are actually like when you get a feature from your developers, you're going through, you're pointing around, you're clicking, you're like typing things in. And as you work on a feature, you might do that, you know, 30, 50, 100 times over and over and over as you're tweaking things and improving them or whatever. A feature test or like an integration test or a headless browser test, whatever you want to call it, is the same thing. It's telling a computer how to load the web page, click on that field, enter this value, press that button, make sure that the next page has these results or has this error message or whatever. it literally runs in a, you know, typically a headless version of Chrome or something like that that's running in a process invisible to you. Or you can even execute these tests in a way where you can actually watch the browser do all your stuff really fast. Mm-hmm. So you're automating a human testing the application. The only place where the only value this really doesn't provide that a human still provides is that visual sort of like, does it look right? And you know, headless browsers are, you know, kind of blind to the design. You can get it to take screenshots and things like that, but by and large, that's still your stakeholders that are running through and making sure that, you know, things don't look broken before it goes to production.
That's kind of the smoke test, right? It's like, does this kind of generally work? And then we throw it into testing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the point here is that human effort is quite extensive, you don't want to, on a big system, you don't want to have to send it to a person to go through all of that stuff, you know, every time you make a change. And so that's the value of automated testing. The other type of testing is where you take an individual component. So say, for example, you have a user object in your system, isolated from everything else, but you have like this user object and it has some, you know, classes are data plus behavior. And you want to write tests to make sure that user object by itself performs certain behaviors in a certain way. And there is definitely a place for this type of testing. But here's the thing. When a lot of times when you're writing high-level integration tests, you are effectively testing testing all of these things in conjunction. So you're testing the user object and you're testing the controller that handles your web requests and like figures out what view to show, and you're testing the view and the content of the view and a bunch of other things like services that you depend on and things like that. So these high level feature tests actually do test a lot of this code through all the different levels of the application.
Sure.
And so what you end up with are a lot of tests that are redundant at various different levels, or maybe not redundant, but lower value than that high level integration test. And more people now, I think, that I work with and friends of mine are starting to see that the tests that give them the most confidence before shipping are those integration tests. Now, one of the problems with integration tests is they're really slow. And one of the benefits of these lower level unit tests is they're super fast because it's not testing a whole bunch of things. It's not testing a bunch of dependencies. It's not testing external services. And so they run really fast. And developers feel like that gives them a really good feedback loop. But honestly, I am coming to believe that like actually the value that those tests provide is in some cases like negative benefit.
Interesting. Can you explain that a little more?
Yeah,
the negative benefit. Yeah.
So it's not just that these tests are lower value. It's that what ends up happening is if you test something too carefully, what you're doing is you're writing code. So all the tests are is code that executes, invokes other code. And here's the thing about code. It's all these definitions of like, oh, this is the interface. And so you call this method with these attributes. And there's a couple of things that happen. First of all, it's really time consuming to do because your code, when you write it for production, you just write all the stuff depending on other stuff. But when you want to test something in isolation, you actually have to do a bunch of ceremony. There's a bunch of setup with mocks and stubs and all of these different engineering tools that we've created to make things more testable or as testing utilities. But then you end up having to sometimes, you know, make the code actually compatible or like, I don't know the right engineering term, maybe like decoupling things so that you can test them in isolation.
Sure.
And so you're spending a lot of time up front making the thing, like setting up the test. You are then spending time, you have to actually write testable code, which is not necessarily valuable in and of itself. And this will make some people cringe, but I'll just say it. Like there is a feedback loop that ends up happening where people say, hey, I do TDD, and the value of TDD is it helps drive the design of my code. Well, when you're doing TDD, one of the goals of the design of your code has to be that it's testable. Well, you only have to write code that is unit level testable if you're writing unit tests.
Right, right.
So you've now taken it, it's a circular logic loop that actually causes you to do more work than you have to do, which is like the antithesis, like not the antithesis, but it's the opposite of what the process of TDD is in the first place, which is come up with the simplest possible solution to your problem to make the test go green. Well, it's a lot easier to write simple solutions to make a test go green when you're testing at the integration level than it is when you're testing like really individual components that make up that larger behavior.
Yeah.
And so, and it's also kind of this like, well, anyway, my point is this, that when that increases the amount of effort, so it takes longer to write the code. That's what I found, which was not satisfactory to me. It never has been. Ever since I've been a consultant, I realized that like, man, I could knock this thing out so quickly. But I got to do a bunch of like unit tests and stuff like that. And it didn't feel right, but that's what everybody said you had to do. And that's what code quality is. And so like you're just writing garbage code if you're not doing all of this stuff. And so I did it for a long time, especially in the context of the agency that I was doing work with. But it didn't feel right. And it felt like, man, we're spending a lot of time not implementing a lot of – we might be creating, quote, very – high quality code, but it didn't feel like we were punching out tons of high value code.
Yeah.
So that's the one problem. Now, how does that turn into a negative benefit? When you've written all of these tests at all these different levels, changing code. So some people will say like, oh, it lets you change things with confidence. Tell you what, it makes me hesitant to change things because you know, when you change this, and this is one of my favorite parts of programming, which isn't a reason to do it in and of itself, but one of my favorite parts of programming is when you've finally just like hammered out this spike branch of a feature that now works and everybody's happy with it, and you have the opportunity to refactor and clean it up to make it more readable and get better reuse and have, you know, less likelihood that you're going to change something in one place and it'll break something in another, or you have like duplication of code and don't repeat yourself and all of that stuff. That's like my favorite thing. I got that from like when I was, you know, in my early teens. I just loved refactoring code. Now, here's the problem. If you have a bunch of tests written against a certain interface for a class, and now you start moving things around to, quote, refactor, like you're changing interfaces and you're changing the structure of the classes and you're changing where this responsibility is sort of in the code base with new classes, then all of a sudden your tests have all broken.
Yeah.
And this is.
And so you're less likely to refactor in the end, right?
Now, here's the question, Craig. Now, if I refactored a bunch of code and the application itself works as it always did, the user experience didn't change at all, when I changed all of that implementation under the surface, why did a bunch of tests break? And
right.
Now
right.
I have to update code in two places. And what you realize is a lot of test suites are the same code written twice, just inverted. Like you've written the implementation in one place, and then you've written the definition or the spec of this low-level sort of aspect of the design in another place. And now anytime you want to change something, you have to change it twice. And I'm not saying it takes twice as long, but it doesn't take the same amount of time as just changing the implementation. And so what I really now value are a very, very robust, even if it runs slow, a very robust integration suite that I can go and change code, a very malleable code base, as opposed to feeling more like concrete. Or even another analogy I would use maybe is like molasses, where you it's malleable, but you go and change it, and then all of a sudden it's like stuck to you, and you're like, oh no, I got this other thing that I have to go change now.
Right. It's a dependency at that point, or like, yeah, it's something you have to carry around with you. Yeah.
And you have to go change other things. And so now I feel like the code base is more malleable. I can go and change implementation. And only if I change the user's behavior, the required behavior of the user, do I then have tests that go that I have to update.
Gotcha. So practically, and this is very selfish because we're going to implement something like this on our business soon. So practically, like, what tool do you use to kind of write and run these tests?
Yeah, so it's going to be, I think, different in different ecosystems. So I don't know what it is in PHP. For me, it's a tool called Capybara, and Capybara WebKit is like my tool of choice or weapon of choice for doing this type of testing. And for me, it just fits into the standard Rails testing framework. I just write more of those tests and fewer of the unit tests. And gotcha. I want to clarify on this. There's definitely a place for unit testing or lower level testing, even if it's integration testing. And here's why. If you have multiple people working on a project, and for some reason the delegation, the line of delineation between two developers is that somebody's working higher in the stack and somebody's working lower in the stack, I'm pretty sure the person higher in the stack is going to want the person lower in the stack to test their code as part of that relationship.
Sure.
But that's not really the context in which I'm suggesting this. The context in which I'm suggesting this is when you have one developer going up and down the entire stack on a particular feature, then I think the value is focusing on those higher level tests. But yeah, for your project, it's going to be, you know, probably similar tools under the hood, but it'll be different libraries probably that are wrapping those tools, like headless Chrome or whatever.
Sure. So in terms of like a mix that you think a standard, and I know there's no standard, but like an average kind of SaaS app would shoot for, a mix between like feature integration tests and unit tests, something like 70% integration tests and 30% unit tests maybe, or what kind of mix do you think?
Yeah, I don't think there is. I think it's, for me, it's 100% feature tests and lower level integration tests to test, you know, particular. It is one of the things that you probably run into is that it doesn't make sense. And I think that people should test more functionality at the integration level than we have historically. Like, I think a lot of people have used integration tests to do like the best case scenario or the most common workflows or whatever. I tend to test a ton of stuff at that level. Failures, errors, edge cases. I do it all at that level because I want to test not just how do things break at a low level, but how is that represented to the user at a high level. So for me, I think, and don't hold me to this because this is an evolving viewpoint, but for me, it's like 100% feature tests. And then there might be reasons why it makes sense, or to be honest, sometimes things are so complicated at the lower level that it's helpful to write tests at a lower level if you're diving into something that's conceptually very difficult, to make sure that you're not losing track of pieces. And in that case, we got those lower level tools. But I would say on a need to use basis. And so there's no particular percentage. I would say focus on the higher level tests. And I wanted to clarify one other thing on that. You had asked, what does one of those tests look like? That test, for example, in Bullet Train, there's a test called a user signs up and manages their account. So what that means is the user starts on the homepage as a visitor. They sign up for an account. They fail a bunch of times because they've put in errant data or non-matching passwords or whatever. Then they finally get in. They subscribe to a plan. They go in. They change their password. They send a password reset email. They sign out. They sign back in. They sign back in with the wrong password. That fails. That's one test. It's a massive epic of storyline for this user. That's just. But you know what? That's what a human tester would do. If they were testing all this functionality, they might do it as separate steps. But in my case, it makes sense just to run it all as once because it's a cumulative test.
Sure.
And that's the other thing. There are a lot of tests that are cumulative that are you come by that naturally at the feature level. Whereas if you're doing it at the unit level, you end up setting up a bunch of state every time for all these different conditions. And again, you're just doing it over and over and over again at all these different levels of the testing sort of suite.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And then again, selfishly, because we're going to implement this, you say it takes a long time to run the tests. What are we talking like for kind of fully covered SaaS app? How long is a long time to run the tests?
The Bullet Train test suite on a super low powered, you know, MacBook 12 inch Retina. So like the lowest power laptop I think they sell, takes like 3 minutes to run. It's really not that bad.
That's nothing. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, I know. I have to go up and like get a coffee refill. It's not. And in CI, though, which is often lower powered for a lot of people, it can take 10, 20 minutes because we're running all these different configurations.
Okay.
And that's not great. Like, I don't love that. I don't love that when I push up a feature branch, my CI box takes 20 minutes to run our test suite like 8 or 16 times or whatever it is. But you know what? Like, I'm not thinking about it either. I'm not waiting for that to execute on my computer. What it isn't is seconds. And so a lot of people that do TDD really love seconds or milliseconds because they are used to, hey, I'm writing this code and then I want to see whether I'm green or not. I save the document. I want to see if I'm green or not. And it's like, I don't necessarily think that in and of itself is worth your head.
You know, I don't, again, not coming from a programming background, I can imagine that would give you a bit of false sense of security too. Because, I mean, just because that test passes doesn't mean that the entire application functions like it should, which is what you're talking about. Is like, is the user experience and the stuff in the browser working like I want it to? Which at the end of the day is really all that matters, right? Like, does your app do what you want it to do and what you expect the user to see? Or not, and then what happens then? But that's why I like this. Is this is really like one? It's all of these variables in the wild, like in the real environment that they're going to live in.
But
it also is kind of like the so what, right? Like okay, we have all these tests. So what? So that everything isn't broken at the end of the day. And if you run these feature tests or browser tests or integration tests or whatever we call them, then you can see yes, my stuff works. The user sees what they should see, and we can all kind of be happy, as opposed to I've run a bunch of unit tests and I get a bunch of green lights, but my app could still kind of suck from a usability perspective, I guess. But I don't know. That's me oversimplifying a little bit, I'm sure. But
you're not at all, Craig. You're absolutely on the money. And I think that so here's one of the other things about this that is so important to me. When you spend so much time, your brain, it's a limited resource. Mine is especially limited. And I say that with no sense of like sarcasm at all. Your brain is limited. And some people may have a capacity for like keeping all of this context like in their brain at the same time or whatever. I don't have it. And here's the thing. If I have to train my brain to operate at one of two levels, and the one level is at the user level, the user experience level, the user interface, click testing, stuff like that. If that's the one option, or I can choose to spend more time in the weeds of like implementation and writing code that's more testable in an isolated class with no dependencies or whatever, however you want to describe that, and unit tests and all of that. If I can choose to live in one of those levels, it's going to be the higher level because that's where the value is. That's why the reason for us doing all of this stuff, it's at that level. It's at features that increase revenue or increase retention, decrease churn, which is the same thing inverted. But like it's in shipping new features that aren't just necessarily for the volume of feature, but a feature that is so high quality or so well thought through that it provides so much value that more customers are onboarded and more customers stay on the platform. So that's in a business context or in an organizational context where you're not actually selling the product, you're just building for stakeholders within an organization. It's about shipping more high value features, not more features, higher value features or more features so that you increase the efficiency of the people who are using the application, which provides the ROI that the business was looking for when they sort of commissioned the application to be built in the first place.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm going to live at the high level every time. And that being said, I work on some extremely complicated low-level algorithms that do really benefit from a lot of unit testing or lower level testing for that particular component. There's definitely a place for it, but that's not the majority of my work. That's like, those are the sorts of projects that come up less often than, hey, we're building a SaaS app and it provides this benefit to the person that I love the example of the HVAC company, the person who works at the HVAC company, and what I prefer to live at that level.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And I think that's most of us. I mean, I think most of us are developing applications where we want the user experience to be solid. And so it kind of makes sense to write tests for that purpose so that we can make sure the user has a good experience and that they get what they need out of it and not sort of like writing tests. Again, maybe oversimplifying, writing tests for the sense of getting the green light so that you feel good about your code. At the end of the day, it's really kind of like, does everything work when you glue it all together? And when you make those changes, does it still work? Because that's really what it is, I think. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Andrew, so super, super wonderful to kind of give me confidence to go to our development team and say, hey, this is how we're going to do things, because I feel really strongly, I have a lot of conviction that this is the right way to do it. So it's nice to hear someone as experienced as yourself to give me that confidence. But I'm sure there are going to be a million questions from people listening about, okay, that's great, but how do I implement this in JavaScript or how do I do whatever? If people want to reach out to you to talk more about this or learn more from you about how you implement this kind of testing in your apps, what's the best way to get in touch with you and learn more and stuff?
Here's what I want people to do. I mean, at the end of the day, it's about where the rubber meets the road. So I'm happy to talk about this and build on these thoughts and hear other people's opinions. I'm sure I don't have this all figured out. I love that. The way that I would love to have the conversation, Craig, is the most important thing we're talking about is what you are going to do with your business, like your business, Craig,
yeah,
in the near future. Like, that's the thing that is of material impact here. So if anybody thinks that I'm like way off base on this and I'm totally wrong, what would be really cool is if they emailed not just me, my email address is andrew@bullettrain.co, but not just to email me, but also CC you. And actually, I think they should address it to you because you're the one who has decisions to make. But I also, if they do email you, send it to me because I want to benefit from their logic and their reasoning for if they have a different approach. I want to be able to build on that. So I think that that's the right context though, right? Like, let's help Craig not screw up the way that they approach testing on this app, because you're going to have to live with it for a long time.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what we should do. On Twitter, absolutely hit me up. I'm at Andrew Culver. My email address, andrew@bullettrain.co.
Awesome. Awesome, Andrew. I really appreciate it. So yeah, anybody who wants to email us, andrew@bullettrain.co, and you can email Dave and I, podcast@roguestartups.com. We'd love to hear people's thoughts. If you want to drop in a comment below this post, feel free to do so as well. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on today and talking about this. And congratulations with the early success you're having with Bullet Train. I think it's something that we'll all continue to watch here for the next several years. I think you really got something great going there.
Thanks so much, Craig. It's always a blast chatting with you. Thanks.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.